David Halberstam once described his friend and fellow journalist James Fallows as one of the most interesting voices of a young generation of political and societal reporters. Fallows was the chief speechwriter for President Carter during his first 2 years in office. When Fallows left, he wrote a controversial article called The Passionless Presidency, which was published in The Atlantic magazine, where Fallows later became Washington editor. He's also the author of National Defense, a critique of U.S. military priorities. James Fallows has been living in Malaysia and Japan for the past 3 years. Perhaps you've been following his reports in The Atlantic and on NPR's Morning Edition. His new book tries to explain American culture by contrasting it with Asian societies. Many experts have made the case that in order for the U.S. to become more competitive, we should become more like the Japanese. Fallows concludes that it's pointless to try to pretend we can become them. We should become more like us, figure out what our own cultural strengths are, and use them. More Like Us is the title of Fallows' new book. It opens with this sentence. The purpose of this book is to remind Americans of how unusual our national culture is and of why it is important that we not become a, quote, normal society.
What I mean is that certain parts of our daily life that Americans just take for granted are actually among the most unusual traits of American society, and you begin to see them clearly only when you live someplace different, including someplace as fundamentally different as Japan. I think the two things that to me seem most abnormal and most necessary about America are, first, the idea that different people from different parts of the world who have different religions and colors and everything else can come together and form one society. That sounds like a bunch of civics text pap to most people in America, I think, but it is a radical idea to most people in the rest of the world. There's virtually no Asian society that believes you can have people of different colors living together successfully in one place, and that's something that is unusual about us and good. The other thing that I think is most unusual, but yet kind of drifts into the background landscape in America, is the idea that people can do what they want with their lives, that women, for example, can have professional jobs if they want, that somebody who happens to be born into one class can at least try to be in a different class, or that people who get a certain job when they're 20 can get a different job when they're 30 if they don't like the job that much. These things all seem just almost boring to Americans, but are radical concepts and are I think, the main tools America has to work with to make itself healthy and strong.
Well, you really make the point in your book about how Japan is really a homogenous culture, both ethnically and in terms of the values that the people there share. And you say that your own modest proposal for solving America's racial problems is to make all white Americans live in Japan for a year or two. It's a quick way to learn how it feels to have your race be the most important and, on the whole, unfavorable thing about you. How have you experienced that? Do you feel like a real minority in Japan?
In many parts of the world, including Africa and Latin America and most of the rest of Asia, you're obviously different as a white person, as a white American. People can tell who you are on sight. There is something – there's an additional edge to that in Japan, I think, because of two overlapping pressures. One is the very powerful Japanese idea of racial homogeneity. I say idea rather than reality because there is some little variation in the Japanese population, but the idea is that there is one pure Japanese race. And so you're constantly aware of being on the outside of that. I'll walk around a corner in Yokohama where I live, and suddenly I'll hear from five little children's voices, "Kaijinda," which means it's an outsider, it's a foreigner. So that's that extra edge that comes from Japan's own emphasis on its homogeneity. Also, there is this sense in Japan that of judging different cultures sort of on their moral worth. And there is the growing sense in Japan that other cultures, white culture, white American culture, black culture in America and in Africa, and virtually all their cultures just aren't up to competing with Japan. And so you have this sense that, for example, if somebody from a Japanese office calls me on Saturday morning, they'll say, "Oh, I'm sorry to be disturbing you. I know you're probably not working on Saturday, but still, we are at the office, so I need to call you." So all these things pile up to kind of emphasize the differentness all the time.
Well, you know, you tell a story about how you and your sons, I think, got into a sauna in Japan and everybody got out.
One of our favorite rituals, and I have taken my sons to, is to go to the public bath, the sento, as they're called, where you It's a big public area. They now are segregated by sex. They used to be co-ed. But you spend about a half an hour getting these big pails of boiling hot water and pouring them over yourselves and just scrubbing every inch of your body with this very coarse soap. And then when you finally have ritually purified yourself, you step into the tub, into this very, very hot tub to get steeped for a while. The first time we did this in our neighborhood, there were about five Japanese men in the tub, and my sons, I had cleaned so that they were, it's not just they were shining, they were almost bleeding from how much I had scrubbed them. But when we got into the water, everybody got out. And I think it was a subconscious thing of just the idea of our skin touching the same water that everybody else was in. It was just too disorienting to the people. They didn't mean to offend us, but it was too much a disturbance. Now, I should say after a while, they would be in the, a few weeks later, they would get in the same tub with us. But it's an expression of an instinct.
Mm-hmm. What's this like for your children? They're in a school in Yokohama where there's around 800 students, and your sons are the only two Americans in the school, the only two
foreigners.
Foreigners, yeah.
It has been the richest and in some ways most difficult, in some ways best experience of their lives. I'm sure that their lives will always be different because of what they've been through there. In most ways, it has been very good. The school has tried hard to integrate them well. Our kids have learned a lot more Japanese than they would know otherwise. A lot of the children have been nice to them. But I think they will always know what it is like to be the outsiders, to know what you know, just all the sorts of casual snubs one bears as an outsider, what they feel like. So I hope this will make them, I hope instead of making them resentful, will make them wiser as they get older.
Journalist James Fallows is my guest, and his new book, More Like Us, looks at American culture through the perspective of living in Asia. And he reports for the Atlantic Monthly, and also you probably hear his reports on NPR's Morning Edition. Many people have stressed to you in Japan that it's easier to manage a country where everyone shares the same values. And I think this is one of the things that you're getting to by stressing the homogeneity in Japan.
Well, it certainly is easier to manage Japan than it is to manage America. You also use the comparison that it's be easier to be governor of Utah than to be governor of New York when mm-hmm. you have a less radically different society. There are fewer disputes to work out. It's again plain from my children's experience in the schools that so much emphasis is placed from an early age on people sharing the same values, learning to cooperate. The children in schools receive individual grades, but also grades on how the whole class has done and how it has cooperated and pulled together. On the other hand, there are certain advantages that New York has over Utah, and that America has over Japan. And I think that the point I'm trying to make in this book is to recognize the areas where we are strong and can be strong. And one of those, the greatest of those, is our very diversity and ability to tolerate difference and chaos and to be more adaptable than I think the Japanese can in the long run be.
Well, in keeping with that idea, you point out how in the United States, people reinvent themselves all the time. They move from one class to another. They change professions. They change locations. They move away from their family. And then they can move back again if they want to. And this is an idea that particularly excites you, I think, living in Japan, where there isn't that sense of constant reinvention.
Your listeners may again have a hard time of saying, well, so what? So people get new jobs. But it is different from how, for example, Japan works. Let me give one or two illustrations. Almost every major company in Japan hires people only at one age. That is people coming directly out of college. That is the job you get when you're 20 or 22 is the job you have. And it also is the job you have if you are a man. If you are a woman, it's the job you have for 3 or 4 years as an office lady, and then you go and you get married and have two children and don't work again except some kind of maybe part-time work later on. We take it for granted that if you are dissatisfied when you're 30 or when you're 50, you can do something different. In many other parts of the world, you can't. When I was leaving Tokyo a couple days ago, I picked up a magazine, a very popular magazine, kind of like Parade in Japan, and the cover was two big Chinese characters saying Todai for Tokyo University. The contents of the magazine were the lists of all the people who'd passed the entrance exam for Tokyo University and therefore would be running Japan for the next 40 years. It is a much more static, all-or-nothing decision than we're able to make. So I think we need to appreciate the looseness that is available here.
This is a concept that has a lot of personal resonance for you since you feel that you and your parents both went through this kind of reinvention.
In my parents' case, you know, we're all victims to a degree of our own experience. The shaping experience in my father's life, my father and mother's life, was when they decided to leave Philadelphia, the suburb of Philadelphia, where they had grown up, and just start a new life in California a little while after World War II. It wasn't so much the difference between Philadelphia and California. It was the fact of they are just making up something new for themselves, and that leaving a place where they had a lot of traditions that were comfortable in some ways and confining in other ways, and going to a new place where they could just figure out new things they wanted to do. And certainly for my father, at least, it was a completely energizing and liberating experience. My mother always had more mixed emotions of missing all the comforts and tradition of Philadelphia while appreciating some of the looseness of California too.
How does this apply, this idea of reinvention? How does it apply to keeping America more competitive in the international marketplace?
Well, it doesn't mean that next week we can improve the trade balance, or that we can have, you know, basic oxygen furnaces in the steel plant next year to deal better with the Japanese. And there are a lot of trade issues that have nothing to do with what I'm talking about. They involve saving incentives and industrial strategies in Japan and so forth. But in the long run, it seems to me that societies either work or they don't economically, depending on the cultural values they have. There are certain societies, and Japan is a leading example right now, that do a masterful job of marrying people's incentives and people's values and people's habits to the larger interests of the country. And I think America is perfectly capable of doing that. This is a very successful country on the whole, but it needs to do it in a different way. And if people feel, if Americans feel that they're not stuck in certain classes, they're not discriminated against on the basis of race or sex, they do have second chances, they can do different things, then they're more likely to behave in ways that help the country economically. They're more likely to start new businesses. They're more likely to have a sense of participation where they work. They're less likely to be resentful and surly and you know, not doing the job right. So it's not an immediate connection to these trade issues, but in the long run, I think that's how societies succeed or fail.
Your book really celebrates cultural diversity. And the kind of diversity we've gotten in the United States through constant immigration through the years of people from different cultures. A lot of people now think we should close down our immigration policies because there's so much competition with workers who are already in the States, and for other reasons as well. Where do you stand on immigration?
I think immigration is America's greatest strategic advantage in the long run over any other country, and it's something we'd be very foolish not to welcome. Let me mention this in different ways. I'm always coming across people in Hong Kong, in Indonesia, in Taiwan, not so often in Japan, but people who for one reason or another are not able in their own home society to use their ambitions. They're in the wrong class in Indonesia, so they can't start a factory there. They didn't go to the right university in Korea. But and America is to these people the place where they can use their ambitions. And this has historically been a great advantage to us, to be the place where people could come and try their best and make things better for everybody. It's also I'm well aware of the frictions that immigration causes, the sense of competition, the sense of differentness, the sense of that the center can't hold and things are flying apart. But it's worth recognizing that that's always been the case. And at the turn of the century, when my grandmother came from Germany, a lot of other people arrived, the sense of competition and differentness was much more acute than it is now. There were articles written then, including in the Atlantic Monthly, about how Italians and Poles, you know, they weren't really people. They were so different from the good Anglo-Saxon stock, they could never be absorbed. So we've been through worse disruptions than this before and are stronger for it, and I think we'll be stronger for the current immigrant disruption.
I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking that as much as we may talk about the ability to reinvent yourself in the United States, that this is almost impossible for people who are in the underclass, who are discriminated against, who can't find employment, can't find housing.
Well, it's certainly true that America's great problem at the moment is the largely black underclass coming from America's great sin in history, which was slavery. And I would use this as an example of how, as the extreme example of how destructive it is to America if people think they can't change and think that they can't succeed. Of the many factors that keep the underclass stuck in place, I think one of the most powerful is this idea that there's no point really in trying in anything except perhaps sports or narcotic sales, because you can't succeed anyplace else. And people who believe they're going to fail do fail. It's interesting to note that black-skinned immigrants from Western Africa and from the Caribbean who suffer the same kind of racial prejudice as people in the black underclass do statistically succeed very well, just like other immigrants in America. So there are barriers of discrimination, but some people are able to overcome them. And so the problem, I think, with the underclass is not simply the discrimination that's helped create it, but now this defeated culture that keeps people where they are.
Most experts who have compared the United States and Japan have looked at the two countries in terms of economics and politics. Your book examines these two countries culturally. What do you think are do you think are some of the things that you get from looking at the two countries culturally instead of just through economics and politics?
I think you see two really different ideas of what the final purpose of life is. As best I can understand the satisfaction of life and the final purpose of life in Japan, it is to perform your duty admirably within some network of human connections. It's to do your duty within your family, to your parents and your children. It's to do your duty within your organization. And that is what morality is finally about. It's what human satisfaction is finally about. That's different from the U.S., where we have some idea of life's fulfillment being as an individual figuring out what is most important for you, although we, of course, believe in duty, et cetera. But these biases are different, and they make for different strengths and weaknesses. I think very few Americans would be satisfied as immigrants to Japan because they would feel there's something lacking in life, that there's not enough to satisfy us just in this performance of duty. It makes for some things that are extremely admirable in Japan, notably the sense that everybody is doing his best almost all the time. That's the thing I constantly admire in Japan.
We were just talking about how you've looked at Asia and the United States culturally instead of strictly economically. So can you just sum up for us some of the different conclusions you think you've reached by looking at it this way?
The main point I'm trying to make about America is that its virtues are unusual in the world. It's probably the only society in the world that really thrives on disorder, that can tolerate the disorder of people moving around, of foreigners coming in, of people deciding to change their lives once they get started. And that instead of being disturbed by this, we should recognize it as our great gift and do things to make it as possible as we can. I spend about the last half of the book talking about factors that make that less possible, the various sorts of class rigidities that make it harder for Americans to feel this mobility. So that's my point, to recognize what makes us what we are.
Why did you decide to go to Asia and set up shop there and write for American magazines?
There were two reasons. One is I'd been living in Washington for a number of years before then and wanted to live someplace besides Washington. The other was that I had been curious about Asia, and like everybody else in the U.S., I heard about the rising Pacific Rim economies, but I'd never seen them. The thing I like most about journalism is the ability to go out and see something for yourself, and then you can develop your own opinions about it. So I wanted to see what it was like. So with my family, we went to Japan first for about 6 months, then we lived in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia for about 2 years, and now back in Japan since last summer.
I enjoy your reports for National Public Radio. Where do you file from? What studio do you record in?
the famous bathroom studio of my own my own house.
Oh no, really?
Yes, because it's my house is so small, like many others in Japan, that if I did any place except the bathroom, you'd hear constantly the chants of all the vendors who drive up and down the streets and selling fried potatoes with this or baked potatoes with the yakiimo call. So I go into the bathroom and hang up various towels and things over the door and sit in the bathtub with a recorder on my lap. That's my studio.
It seems that shopping and buying ordinary goods takes on a completely different meaning for you as an American in Japan. For instance, you tell a great story about how the whole family wanted slippers to wear in the house, so you decided to order from L.L. Bean, and for the family of four, the slippers came out to $108, but you had to pay a lot more than that.
Yeah, the tariff, I think, was another $250 or something like that. It was 154% tariff. And this is, I think, something that for foreigners living in Japan, they most want to convince people in America about. When you hear the stories about high prices in Japan, you think, oh, well, this is just because of the exchange rate. These people are whining. The real point is that everything in Japan for the Japanese has an exorbitant cost because of the various protections built into the economy and its orientation towards export rather than consumer welfare. The intriguing thing is that nobody complains. Nobody complains that there's 154% tariff on shoes or leather goods. Nobody complains that rice costs eight times as much as it does in the U.S., literally eight times as much. Nobody complains, most mysteriously of all, that every single Japanese-made product I have ever seen costs more in Japan than it does in New York or Los Angeles or any place where it's exported. So this is the moral meaning of shopping, that there's some real economic distortion that it reveals, but it seems intriguing only to foreigners, not to the Japanese themselves.
So you think that the Japanese don't complain about the higher prices because they think it's finally good for the country?
I think so. I think that there is a more tribal sense of the welfare of the society, that they don't want to hurt their producers, their big companies, and so they just don't complain about the prices they have to pay.
Have you been watching your American money decrease in value over the years?
It is just too painful even to think about. And so when I come back to the U.S., I am startled by how cheap everything is. I can hardly believe it. But my wife and I find the only way we can remain sane in Japan is not to convert things into dollars. If you think that something costs if I think in a hotel I'm paying 1,000 yen for a beer, I'm used to that. If I think that means $8, then I get depressed.
You know what I'd like to know? In dealing with the cultures of Japan and the United States, how do you deal with cultural traits without reducing them to stereotypes? I think it's a very tough thing to do.
It is very tough, and I'm probably guilty of well, there's a risk for me and for anybody else who writes about Japan in being guilty of that, because compared to most other cultures, Japan is more homogeneous than most other places. And there are certain things that sound like stereotypes that are in fact true. So it is a very difficult problem in talking about Japan in particular, and I don't know how to overcome it.
Mm-hmm. One of the stops you've made in the years that you've been living in Asia is Vietnam.
Yes.
And now Vietnam is a subject you've written about, and you have a now famous piece about why you think there should be a universal draft. You weren't drafted. You were of a privileged class, and you had ways of getting out of it between a student deferment and knowing how to fast so that you'd be underweight. And as you pointed out in the article, people who were less educated and less financially secure wouldn't even know the tricks of getting out of the draft. So you recommended a universal draft so that everybody would be in the same boat, and if a policy was bad, all the parents and all the people of draft age would be fighting it together. Did your opinions undergo any change after visiting Vietnam?
There was one enormous surprise of going to Vietnam, and made me wish that in addition to white Americans living in Japan, that all Americans could go to Vietnam, because in Vietnam there is no sign that the U.S. was ever there. You find very few English speakers, almost no war materiel, very little interest in what it was like when the Americans were there, because what the Vietnamese refer to as the American War was about an eight-year period preceded by the French War and followed by the Chinese War and the Cambodian War, and it is basically not important to them anymore. And it's not important to very many people in Asia anymore. The refugees are still important, but nobody talks about the rights or wrongs of Vietnam that I've come across in the Philippines or Korea or Japan. And so it made me realize that the only place where the Vietnam War is still important, still an emotional issue, is in America, not in Asia. And I think that there's a kind of lancing of the boil effect that comes from seeing that and seeing that it is old and uninteresting history in Vietnam itself.
And has that made you think less about the war?
Well, it's made me, I guess, wish that in America we could do whatever it takes to have the same finished business approach to it. That, you know, resolve the maybe we won't ever be able to resolve all the emotional damage that the war did, but it might be easier if we realize that it's our own internal problem. It doesn't matter to other people.
How long are you going to stay in Asia?
I believe for until probably late this year, maybe September or so. I would selfishly, I would like to stay longer than that. I will probably travel back and forth, but I think the imperatives of my children mean that it would be rough on them to keep them in Japanese school or away from what they are beginning to think of as their lost homeland for much longer.
Why would you want to stay?
It is the most interesting thing I've ever done. Where every day you see something that you didn't know about the day before, and so it's a period of my life I'll be very sad to see come to a close.
What do you think you're going to write about when you come back to the States?
I think I will be much less interested in politics in Washington and much more interested in sort of these large cultural currents that make the U.S. go.
And why?
And why will it be interesting? The Washington politics itself seems more parochial and kind of a toy town than not that different from politics in Jakarta, except in its consequences. And the social traits of you know, how the races get along together, of what makes people feel happy or sad, that seems more interesting because it begins to seem to me more unusual about America.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your observations with us. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks.